The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we'll be exploring the science of sound. A little later on, we'll speak to Dr. Andrew Wise about a cochlear implant that delivers gene therapy. But first, we'll visit with a sound tourist to hear about his travels to find the most unique and interesting noises in the world. Enjoy. This is Science for the People, and I'm Desiree Schell. I'm joined by Trevor Cox, professor of acoustic engineering at the University of Salford and immediate past president of the Institute of Acoustics. He was awarded IOA's Tyndall Medal in 2004, and he has a long track record of communicating acoustic engineering to the public. He's presented 18 documentaries for BBC Radio, including Life's Soundtrack, Save Our Sounds, and Science vs. the Strad. He's here to talk about his new book, Sonic Wonderland, A Scientific Odyssey of Sound. Welcome, Trevor.
Good to talk to you.
Can we start out with an overview of your background? Because that in itself is fascinating.
Well, I started off as a scientist, I guess. I did a physics degree. And when I decided what research topic I fancied doing, I decided to combine my interest in physics with my amateur musicianship, because I play the saxophone at the moment. And the obvious subject to go to seemed to be acoustics. So I ended up doing research in acoustics, and that's been what I've been doing ever since.
So what kinds of sound projects have you worked on?
Well, I started off in room acoustics, which is about designing, say, a concert hall so that the acoustic of the room embellishes the orchestra to make it sound more beautiful. But it can also be more everyday spaces like a classroom and how noise might affect the learning of pupils within that classroom. So that was my starting point, was room acoustics. But since then, as I think you do in a research career, it kind of broadens and gets wider than that. And I do a lot of work in audio at the moment, working with BBC.
So when you're doing things like that, what kinds of things do you have to take into account?
Well, one of the things which makes acoustic engineering fascinating to me is that it's not just about the physics of how sound moves around, how sound is made. It comes down in the end to how people listen. Ultimately, when I design something, I don't know, a washing machine, which I'm trying to design to make it sound nice, it's not some, you know, physical measure tells me whether that machine's good. It's actually some, you know, in the kitchen, is it an annoying sound? So to really do acoustic engineering, you have to understand what goes on between the ears. You have to understand the listener. And that's what makes it very tricky, but also very fascinating.
And also, I guess you have to take into account content, what the audience is going to be listening to in those spaces.
Yes, and also what the spaces are designed for. So if you take a hall for music, the design you might do for a concert, for a classical orchestra, would be very different to if you, say, had a rock band playing. So in a rock band, they will use electronics, and actually they want the room to be rather dead. They really would rather the room wasn't there. It's a bit of an inconvenience. Whereas to the classical orchestra, if you take the room away, they all sound rather dry, thin, and remote. So it does depend on what the act is, what the room has to do.
Now, so you started out in physics, and physics is very objective, while something like sound is very subjective. Do you ever have difficulty reconciling those two?
I think it's what makes it interesting and what makes it tricky to work with. It's actually much easier to work, in a sense, with an end goal, which is something physical, like I get my sound level meter out and I measure how many decibels I get on it. It's a definite number. Every time I measure it, it will be kind of roughly the same. Whereas you can get a human being and you can sit in the room and say, well, what do you think of that sound? And one day they could say it's lovely, and the next day they could say, well, they're not that really interested in it. Because our opinions vary, and also understanding what drives people's opinions about sound is complicated, because it depends on your upbringing. This morning, of all things, I was discussing dog barking, and we're discussing whether you owned a dog or not affects your perception of dog barking. It's got a weird conversation, but it almost certainly does. So how do you account for that in your modeling of people's perceptions of barks, for example? It's a really complicated subject.
Now, you've written a book, which is typically full of words, and you are trying to write a book about sounds, and sometimes very specific sounds. Did that present any challenges?
I think it presents lots of challenges, and I think poets and authors of fiction find the same issue as well. The English language isn't that well set up for describing sounds. I mean, it's actually quite a lot of words which can describe a sound, but only very few of them are kind of in common use. So you get a word like twang, which I guess across the pond is as much in use as in Britain. But there's lots of other words which describe sounds, and, you know, the character of them, but they're kind of obsolete. They're not used very often. And therefore, you haven't got a very large sort of, you know, set of words to work from, which makes it hard. But, you know, it's just something I had to really work on. And if you look at travel literature, or you look at fiction, particularly older fiction, like people like Hardy, people become adept at trying to paint pictures in the mind, to use a cliche. And I had to do the same. I had to paint the sound in the ear, I guess.
Well, why is that so difficult to explain sound? Is there a reason for that, do you think?
Well, one of the reasons, I think, is because when we look at sound, or sorry, hear sound, what we first try and do is try and identify the source of the sound. And that comes back to what our hearing is all about. Our hearing, from a sort of evolutionary perspective, was first and foremost an early warning system. So if if something's creeping up from behind, your only real warning system we have is our hearing. I mean, we can't look behind unless we turn our head. And our smell isn't very good. As human smell isn't really particularly good. And if you want to identify a threat, you don't want to say, oh, that's a sort of twong sound. You want to say that's a lion, or that's someone creeping up behind me, going to hit me on the head with something. You actually want to know what it is. So I think we automatically try and identify sources. And there's been some studies on city sounds to show this is true. Our first reaction to sound is to try and identify what it is. And that then drives our association with that source, then drives our feeling towards it.
So then how would you explain something like the burping sound of the sand that you speak about in the book? Could you try and describe that to us?
Yeah, interestingly, burping is the description that's given in the scientific literature. In acoustic literature, you don't often see the word burp, but there it is in all the papers. But I actually don't think the sound's quite described right, because I think it sounds more like someone's got a tube rat and is just playing some odd notes. So as you walk on the sand dune, it sort of goes parp, 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 parp as you go along. And I think it's very much like a tuba playing. And that's one trick to describing sounds. It's actually to give an analogy. And that's one of the tricks, rather than try and describe the sound quality, it's actually to say it sounds like. And that's one of the solutions to writing about sound.
Now we're actually going to play that sound for the audience, and we'll see if that's anything like you just described. And I personally think that was very close. Now, you refer to part of what you do as sound tourism. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, sound tourism was an idea I came up with a few years ago, which in the end ended up being this book. It was a sort of strange sort of thought process. I was actually down a sewer. I was asked to do an interview about the acoustics of a sewer. And so I went down there. It's not a very pleasant place, I can tell you. I won't go there again. And the acoustics were quite marvellous. And I heard this amazing spiralling effect. In these brick sewers, these old Victorian storm drain I was in, it was cylindrical in shape. And as you talked, the sound, you could hear it sticking to the inside of the cylinder and spiralling around. And it was a sound effect I'd never heard before. And it just kind of triggered this thought in my mind. What other remarkable sounds have I never heard, and what would be the most remarkable sounds in the world? And so I sort of got this idea that I'd start collecting remarkable sounds, and I came out of the sewer a few hours later, fortunately, and went on the internet, looked around. I thought there'd be lots of websites saying the top 10 sounds in the world, but actually there was really little. And so I started this idea that maybe we should start thinking about places we should go, not just for our eyes, but for our ears.
Well, and so sound tourism is definitely not a thing, because you basically created it, which is wonderful. But how do you hear about all these interesting sounds and their locations?
Well, I set a website up, which is still there. It's called sonicwonders.org. And I sort of put a few obvious ones up that I could think of that I'd met in my travels. I mean, there are a few things from travel guides, like in St. Paul's Cathedral, we have the Whispering Cat Gallery. Across from Vancouver, you've got the steam clock. So there are a few which kind of exist that are known about. And then I just started asking friends and family and people in acoustics for ideas. And of course, on the internet, people started sending me in ideas. And I started sort of kind of expanding my list. And in the end, I ended up with quite a large website.
Well, now, you mentioned the idea of remarkable sounds. So what does remarkable mean to you?
that was one of the challenges in writing the book, actually, was what to include and what not to include. And some of it's subjective. Some of it's about me going, you know, did when I heard that sound, did I go, wow, was it remarkable? So things which are particularly loud or particularly unusual, particularly unsurprising sounds. So, for example, the sound of a bearded seal sounds like an alien spacecraft landing. So that to me is just like, well, this is just weird. And that to me makes me go, wow, and makes it remarkable. And then sometimes it's about things like rarity. So the sounds of sand dunes burping and then droning. There's not very many places in the world that does it. And then sometimes it's about something which just is interesting, something which sort of kind of reveals something about us as humans or something about our hearing. So it's a kind of whole host of different things. But, you know, I put under this sort of statement of remarkable, but it's quite hard to pin down.
You're listening to Science for the People, and I'm talking to Trevor Cox about his book, Sonic Wonderland. Now, you've pointed out in the book that we have no natural way of shutting down our hearing, of shutting it off. We have no ear lids, as it were. Does that present some problems?
Well, it creates problems in things like noise and the annoyance. You know, if it's maybe your neighbor's next door neighbor's barking dog, or they're having a loud party, that it's not, you know, we don't naturally can't do what we do with our vision, which is just to avert our gaze. And we can obviously block our hearing with earplugs and the such like, but basically our hearing is forever on unless we mechanically shut off our ear canals. And yeah, that does cause problems with noise annoyance. And I think we don't realize all the time we're having to work hard to deal with noise that is around us. I think the best example of that is at the end of the day, you turn your computer off and you suddenly hear the fan dying away. You think, God, I've been listening to that all day. And it's only when it changes because you turn it off do you notice you've been working hard. Your brain's been working hard to cancel out that sound.
So then it's probably fairly difficult for us to isolate not only sounds, but sort of the components of sound.
Well, we've actually got an amazing ability for hearing. If you take going into a crowded party, a crowded pub, a crowded cafe, and you can focus in on one person talking in that hubbub of sound, that's a skill that we can't yet mimic using computers and microphones. That's still, the human brain is much better than that, than any technology that we can currently make. So actually, we've got really sophisticated hearing. And it's interesting that people talk about, you know, want to improve their hearing. Actually, if you listen to music, you have a conversation, you are using vast amounts of your brain and vast amounts of processing power already in very sophisticated hearing. All you need to do if you want to improve your hearing is just to pay attention a bit more, which is something which is actually quite simple to do. That's just a decision to be made.
Well, let's break down some of the concepts that you talk about in the book. What exactly is reverberation?
Well, reverberation is actually where architectural acoustics started. And I suppose it's the sound that happens in the room after sound stops. So if I go into a concert hall and the orchestra plays the last note and finishes, that sound will linger a bit in the hall a bit longer, maybe a couple of seconds. Or if I was to go into a cathedral, a bit more reverberant, and the organ was to play, when the organ stops, you can hear it echoing around, usually above your head, rattling around inside the stonework for a long time before dying away. And that's reverberation. And in a cathedral, it might be 6-10 seconds, typical sort of time it takes to die away. And it's important in music because it enriches the sound. It makes music sound better. So even in pop music, one of the first things any music producer does to a singer's voice when they've recorded it is to add some reverberation to make it sound richer. It's a bit like when you want to sound good when you're singing, you go into the bathroom and sing in the shower because you sound a bit richer. That's all to do with the reflections from the room.
But how does it work?
Well, it's physically sound bouncing around the room. So if I was talking to someone in a room, there's a direct sound, which is just going straight from my mouth to their ears. And that doesn't matter where I am, really, whether I'm indoors or outdoors. That's the same thing. What's the added stuff is all the sound that reflects off the walls, off the floor, off the ceiling, and all the other objects in the room. And it sound can rattle around for a very long time if the surfaces are really hard, so the sound doesn't get absorbed when it reflects off the walls.
Well, why are some reflections seemingly helpful and some are detrimental?
That comes down to our hearing. So we have, when we're going around in our everyday life, we're being bombarded by reflections. And our hearing had to find a way of coping with this. If we were to listen to each reflection separately, we'd just become overwhelmed. So we kind of lump the reflections in with the initial sound we hear and just call it one sound event in our brain processing. So provided the reflections arrive quite early, our brain will just hear it as just one sound event. It changes the timbre, the tone of the voice a bit. It might make it sound louder, but basically we still only hear one voice. If the reflections become very delayed, so if I was to go, say, near a big cliff, maybe 30, 40 metres from a big cliff and yodel near there, then you'd hear a distinct sound reflection off the cliff, and your ear is no longer going to say there's one yodel and combine it into one. It'll hear the yodel I make initially, and then it'll hear the reflections of the cliff as a separate sound, and that's an echo. And so essentially those sounds, when the sounds get too far apart, the reflections and the direct sound, they're heard separately. And they can be detrimental. A really good example of that's in a railway station where you're listening to multiple announcements at the same time. You should only hear one, but you hear it's the same platform being announced from multiple loudspeakers, and it makes it very difficult to understand the speech.
Now, you can actually measure reverberation, right?
Yes, because it's been around for a long time, it's been shown to be probably the most crucial measure within design of things like concert halls and lecture theatres. There have been measurement methods around for ages. And there's very strict sort of laboratory measurement methods where you make all sorts of weird chirps and sounds out of loudspeakers. Or you can just measure what's called the impulse response, which is literally you stick a microphone in the room and you make a very short, sharp sound and you measure what you get on the microphone. And you can do that in a small room with a balloon burst. Bigger rooms, you might get out a starting pistol.
And you've done this in many, many locations. And here's where we get to the sound tourism. You compared the reverberation in a number of different locations. Tell us about some of them, the ones that you really liked.
Yeah, I went, part of looking for remarkable sounds, I sort of got out the Guinness Book of Records. It seemed like a good place to start. And no, it's a place which had the world's longest echo is what it was described of in Guinness. It really is the longest reverberation time, but it's for they call the record the longest echo. And I went and visited it. It's up near Glasgow. It was a mausoleum where the Duke of Hamilton was buried. Unfortunately, him and his relatives had to be moved because the whole mausoleum got undermined and started sinking. There's no bodies in it anymore, but there's a chapel there which has got a very long reverberation time, and it is this most grandiose space. I mean, Duke of Hamilton obviously thought a lot of himself when he had this place built. But when I visited it with a lot of acousticians on a visit after a conference, we kind of were chatting, thinking, well, it's not that reverberant, really. So I started thinking about, well, this is a record that could be beaten. And I thought that could be quite a fun thing to do as part of the book, would be to beat the record. So I started looking for places. And I came to the realization quite quickly what I needed was something very large. So it takes a long time for the sound to bounce around the room. And you also need very hard walls. So you need something made out of concrete or stone. So something like a cathedral is great because it's very large. But the stained glass and the wooden pews, they all would absorb the sound a little bit. So they're not going to be as reverberant as something which is no windows and something which is very simply shaped and made out of hard concrete. And that eventually made me end up in an oil storage tank in Scotland, of all places. I heard about this place, which is right at the top of Scotland, and it was built to hold the naval shipping oil during World War II, and it was buried into the side of a hill to stop German bombing taking it out. So to go into it, you walk down this long tunnel down the inside of the hill, and then off the side you find these four big pipes, because there's no doorway. It wasn't designed for people to go into, but what you have is four pipes, and you go through the pipework to get into this place, which is like this vast concrete cavern, and it has the most amazing reverberation time.
And you faced some particular challenges in measuring the reverb in that tanker?
Well, your first challenge is any measurement equipment has to fit down the pipes as well as you do. And they're only about, 40, 50 centimetres in diameter. So it's quite a squeeze to get in. And so there's no power. So you can't take anything which is mains powered. You have to have anything which is battery powered. And even down to simple things like when you're making the measurements, you're in this place. It's 2.5 football pitches long. It's black. You're just working with head torches. And the person who's firing this gun is 100 meters away from you. How do you signal you're ready to make the measurement? You can't make any noise because it takes about a minute for the sound to die away. So we had to sort of learn a Morse code system with torches to try and signal to each other. So there's all sorts of problems. And the floor's covered in oil as well. It's pretty yucksome. Even though it's been cleaned, it's still most of the measurement gear got covered in shipping oil as well.
I have to mention one other echo-related story because I need you to tell this, because we frequently on the show, we try to debunk myths. And you yourself debunked a duck-related echo myth.
Yes, this is an echo myth which never seems to die. It's interesting enough. We were asked years ago about this phrase, which I don't actually know the origin of. I tried to research it, couldn't find out where it comes from, which is a duck's quack doesn't echo and no one knows the reason why. And it's still circulating today, even though we try to debunk it. So the premise is, in some weird way, when a duck quacks, there's no echo from it. But every sound echoes. I mean, echo is a reflection off a surface. And the rather boring phrase is that a duck's quack does echo, but it's rather difficult to hear. But that's not quite as nice a snappy a phrase, is it? So we actually got ducks in and measured them, is what we did in the end, or a duck in, and did some measurements on them to prove that, in fact, a duck quack does echo.
How did you do that? How do you measure a duck's echo?
Well, first of all, we wanted to kind of find sort of the baseline. So what would a duck sound like when there was definitely no echo? So we took them into an anechoic chamber, which we have at Salford University. So an anechoic chamber is this weird room covered in foam wedges on the floor, on the walls and on the ceiling. So any sound you make immediately just disappears into the wall. So you don't get any of the room reflections. So we took the duck in there and we measured the duck just quacking, and it sounded like a quack. But there we go. That was our baseline kind of measurement. And then we took the duck next door. We have a measurement room called a reverberation chamber, which I suppose you might think of like an echo chamber that sometimes is used sometimes using electronic music. And when the duck quacked in there, it was a magnificent sound. It kind of sounded like a sort of vampire duck, because the sound rattled around so long. And that kind of proved to us that, yes, a duck's quack does reflect off surfaces and does echo in the way you might expect. And then I did some simulations of what would happen when you took a duck near a cliff. And the reality is, if you think about it, when you go out to somewhere, someone says, oh, there's a really good echo here, you don't go quack, do you? The first thing you do is you shout really loud. So the reason the duck's quack isn't heard very often is it's just too quiet. I mean, the duck's not quacking loud enough. And also you have to find a cliff at just the right distance, and all sorts of other factors going on. So it's just one of these strange myths which has developed. It has no foundation in fact, and who knows why it started.
You have a great job, sir.
Yeah, there was the headline in the, I think it was the Mail, saying, what are we paying this university professor to do? But most of the papers thought it was a good laugh. It was funny because we did it as part of the Festival of Science, so it was great because it got lots of publicity for, communicating science to the public. And I went and did the press conference, and I said to the organisers of this prestigious Festival of Science, you don't really want me to talk about ducks, do you? The science editors aren't going to be interested. But of course, the pictures of the duck in the anechoic chamber were silly. The sounds were silly, and they just had a big laugh, and the photo editors lapped up. So the pictures of the duck and the anechoic still circulate around papers today.
And we'll be back after these messages with more of Trevor Cox and his book, Sonic Wonderland, right here on Science for the People.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, here with Trevor Cox, professor of acoustic engineering at the University of Salford, and author of Sonic Wonderland, A Scientific Odyssey of Sound. So now all the aspects of sound that we've spoken about so far are monaural, and I don't know if I'm mispronouncing that. Can you correct my pronunciation, and can you explain it?
Well, I'm not sure I know what the correct one is. I mean, I suppose we would call it monaural, but I mean that could be an abuse of English as much as yours might be, for all I know. But monaural means, I suppose, single-sounded. But it means it really, if you put your finger in one ear, so you're literally listening to just with one ear, it would sound pretty much the same. So monaural is, mono, as you might have heard in years gone by on radio. But mostly when we're going around, we're listening in binaural. We have two ears, and that's incredibly important because it allows us to tell where sound is coming from. And as our ears are important for early warning systems, it's important to detect not only where dangers are but where they're coming from. But we also use our two ears very crucially in the crowded pub, the crowded cafe. Having two ears makes it much easier to pick out that single speaker in a crowded voice, and that's a process called binaural masking, and that's really important to our ability to converse in crowded places.
Well, it's also important because that has the ability to completely mess with our heads, right?
Yes, one of the things that is hard to portray in sound on the internet is how some of the effects I came across were actually about, you know, fooling my sense of localization. So normally we localize sound using the fact we have two ears. So if the sound arrives first at the right ear, we kind of know the sound's coming from the right side. Those kind of techniques we can use. But there are cases where our hearing can be fooled, and big curved surfaces can do that. So I visited a room which was completely spherical. So this was a radar dome, which used to cover over antennae, which were used to spy on the East during the Cold War. So this was actually near Berlin. And so there's this sort of dome-shaped sort of ball on top of this big derelict tower. And it has the most amazing acoustic inside. Of course, it wasn't designed for acoustic purposes. It was designed to protect the antennae from weather and ice and water and wind, and to make the Germans not know which way we were pointing the antennae when we're spying on them. So it was not it's not for acoustic purposes it was built, but it has the most amazing acoustic. And it was really apparent as soon as I arrived. So I got into the middle of it, right in the center of the sphere, I knew it'd be most interesting. And if I just kind of leant to one side, I could focus the sound on one of my ears. So I leant slightly to the right, I could focus this great big reflection into my left ear, and you could whisper sweet nothings into your own ear, something you wouldn't be able to do anywhere else.
And there are tons of legends that involve this property of sound, correct?
Yes, there's an interesting legend which is in Italy, which is there's a cave which is called the Ear of Dionysus, and the idea was this tyrant back in many BC, can't remember the number off the top of my head, used to spy on prisoners. So the prisoners were at the bottom of this cave, and the cave is kind of ear shaped. It's sort of more like a sort of donkey ass's ear shape, and it points at the top, so it's a wedge really. And there was a little cavern right at the top, and the theory goes that the reflections off the wedge would focus the sound into this little cavern at the top, and so Dionysus could spy on what his prisoners were saying from the top. And indeed, a wedge does funnel sound. You can actually kind of do the sort of kind of physics. You can work it out. That's true. But the place is so reverberant, the cave is so echoey, that any tests that have been done have kind of indicate that it wouldn't have worked very well. And I suspect this myth has developed because when you look at the entrance to the cave, it kind of looks like an ear. So that's probably why it developed this listening myth about it.
Well, there are some present day examples using that exact technique, that it's almost mischievous acoustics, and I'm thinking of the Whispering Walls.
Whispering Walls, the most famous one, I guess, in England is the Whispering Gallery at St. Paul's Cathedral. So if you go and find a very large curved wall, or in the case of St. Paul's Cathedral, it's the inside of the dome, or in case of the listening station, the radome, you could do that on the inside of the curved wall of the radome. If you whisper into a curve, then the sound will actually stick to the inside of this concave curve and whiz around quite happily. And so in St. Paul's Cathedral, you can whisper into the wall of the dome, and 30-odd metres away, right on the other side, your friend can hear it kind of emerging, and it sounds like the sound's coming out the stonework, so it sounds quite kind of mysterious. But what's actually happening is the stone just kind of sticks to the wall. And it was something that was sorted out by Lord Rayleigh, I don't know, I guess 120 years ago or something like that. And if you imagine making a circular pool or snooker table and firing off the white ball just to skim the edge of this circular pool table, you'll find the white ball will just stay near the edge. It's a kind of, it comes because of its geometry.
Now, I realize we've been spending a lot of time talking about sort of man-made structures, but natural structures have just as interesting sonic properties. Can you please talk about the Singing Dunes? Because I really want to get to that.
Yeah, I have a slight bias because my original area of research was architectural acoustics. And one of the delights of writing the book was an excuse to go and find out about lots of natural acoustics, which it's not something I particularly work in. And I suppose that the best one of those, and one which was on my list to go and visit from day one, was Singing Sand Dunes. I mean, these I knew about because they've been very controversial scientifically. There's been people falling out who trying to argue about, you know, what the actual cause of these are. And they've been known about for centuries, and there's ancient Chinese writing on them. Charles Darwin wrote about them, Marco Polo wrote about them. So they're something that's been known about, but they're quite rare. And there's about 40 dunes now that have been found which exhibit this behaviour. And the sort of the sound effect that you're looking for is this droning sound. And so you have to go to a dune. You have to go in the heat of summer because the dunes have to be dry. If the grains are wet, it doesn't work. So when I went to the Mojave Desert in California. So it was like 40 degrees Celsius when I was there, just in the start of the morning. And you climb up in this dune, and you have to find the side which is on the lee side, so where the wind isn't blowing. and you create an avalanche. And if the wind's really high, the avalanches will create themselves spontaneously. If not, you have to sit down your backside and skirt down. And you, when you start it going, you can feel the whole dune starting to vibrate underneath you. And you get this amazing droning tone coming out. And on a day when it's really working well, it can be heard kind of a mile away. So it can get really loud.
Well, so why do they sing? What's the mechanism?
Well, we know some of the properties that have to be right for it to work. So we know that these grains of sand all have to be roughly the same size. And that's because what happens is some form of synchronized avalanche, because the grains all have to move in synchrony for them to create this very distinctive tone. And if all the grains are different size, they wouldn't be moving in synchrony. And also, if you had lots of little grains and big grains, they sort of inhibit the movement. So we know the grains all have to be the same size, which is one of the reasons it's quite rare, because most sand dunes, the sand grains are lots of different size. We also know that they have to have a particular varnish on them. So they have to have a coating, so the friction is just right, so they can slip past each other and yet have a little bit of friction to create the tone. But then beyond that, the arguments are really around why do you get this synchronized movement. And there's a researcher in Caltech who thought it was to do with a wave guide. You know, you've got a layer of loose sand on the top of the dune and that's what creates it. But there's another researcher in France who says no, you don't need a wave guide at all to get this effect to work. So they're still arguing about exactly how these grains synchronize in this avalanche.
And how long did it take you to get that effect to work?
Well, it took a long time, as in anywhere across the other side of the pond, took a long time to get there, you know, just driving across the desert. And then we went on day one and we couldn't get it to work. I think the mistake we made is we were at Kelso Dunes, and this is rising out of a scrubland desert plain. And we kind of like, well, okay, let's go to the top. It's bound to sound better. There must be some human psychology going on there. And we went up to the top and we tried it, and we got, it was pretty pathetic, the sounds we were getting. So we went back and camped. We allowed 2 days. Fortunately, so we went back and camped at the bottom of the dune again, because you can't stay up there very long, obviously, because it's so hot. You can only do a few hours. And then the second day up, we found a slope which was a bit more square onto the wind and wasn't at the top. So we didn't take the let's charge the top and start there. We actually were a bit more considered, and I kind of worked out we needed probably a longer slope and we needed probably a steeper slope. So we found one part of the way up, and that worked beautifully.
I assume that's one of the reasons why you talk a lot more about man-made structures than natural structures, because natural structures don't care about your timelines.
No, I mean, one of the great delights in the book was to interview some natural recordists, people who go off and record things like ice flows. And, one of them was Peter Cusack, who's a sound artist who's recorded Lake Baikal as it gradually defrosts, the sort of effects that you're probably familiar with in Canada, all the lakes kind of gradually defrosting and all those kind of effects. And, yeah, I think, as with all these sort of natural history things, patience is required. So, yeah, at least in a building, you know what it's going to be like, but you can still turn up and get defeated by sort of kind of logistics. I remember going to make measurements once at the Royal Albert Hall in London and finding that they'd allow us time to make measurements, but they'd also allow time for the cleaners to hoover everywhere, which completely ruined our measurements. So sometimes other things get in the way.
You're tuned into Science for the People, and my guest is Trevor Cox, and we're talking about his book, Sonic Wonderland. Okay, so that is a lot about sound. But what about the absence of sound? You also explored silence in your book.
Yeah, I think silence is really interesting, because I think there's sort of different kinds of silence. So that's what really came to me from the book. So if I want to get what might be the purest and nearest thing to silence you can imagine, I can just walk down the corridor at Salford University and go into the anechoic chamber. I can close the walls and the doors up, and I will hear no sound from outside, because it's a chamber designed to let no sound in. But the interesting thing is you don't actually hear silence. And this is one of the inspirations behind John Cage's famous silent piece of music, 4 minutes 33, was going into an anechoic chamber and finding there is no such thing as a silence in them. And the reason is your body makes sounds. And I suppose the most obvious one is breathing, but you can always hold your breath. But then you might hear the blood pumping in your head, a bit like when you're exercising hard and you hear that dun dun dun. So you sometimes hear the blood pumping in your head. And you can also hear high-pitched hissing sounds. And no one's really researched exactly what they are, but it's widely thought to be the nervous system. Because one of the fascinating things about the ear, which was discovered not that many decades ago, is we have more neural connections from the brain to the ear than from the ear to the brain. So it's kind of largely assumed in the past that we kind of have sound coming into the ear and it gets piped up to the brain. But actually, your brain is actually, it's a two-way street, and your brain is spending a lot of time tweaking what the inner ear is doing to try and maximize what it can hear. And what it does when you go into someone very silent, like an anechoic chamber, is it essentially turns the gain up. It turns the amplifier up in an effort to hear it for the silence. And that can create firings on the auditory nerve, which you hear as a hissing sound.
Well, you went to a number of places, not just the chamber, to experience something resembling silence, at least. And I have to say, your explanation of what a Buddhist retreat is like is glorious. Can you talk about that? Because you sounded miserable.
It was quite, I went, someone who, a colleague in the sort of acoustics kind of said, oh, you have to go on a Buddhist retreat. That's what you'll have to do. So I signed up for one, but it was quite, I'm a very busy guy, and I kind of was on my way there and realized I really hadn't really prepared myself very much for what was going to happen. I was just going to go along and experience. And it was when I realized there were, I can't remember, 10, 12 meditations a day, that I realized actually I didn't really know very much about meditation. This was going to be quite hard work. But it was really a fascinating experience, because by silence, it's not silent in this sort of anechoic chamber. There's no sound. In fact, it was really noisy. There was a rookery just outside the door, so outside the window. So it was really noisy. But what it means is no speaking. And it is weird to go and arrive at a place and then spend 3 days not talking to anyone else. There was about 50 other people there. And it did seem quite a strange sort of existence. And I found it quite odd to be among people and not be able to socialize. But obviously people who like retreats find it quite, relaxing to not have to play the game of who you are and have to be gregarious or have to sort of communicate and just be yourself and not have to worry about others.
In that vein, you visited another place where you were kind of miserable. the most tranquil place in the UK. I would like you to tell us about that. But I would also like to point out that I don't think you like silence, sir.
I think it's got its place. I think what I like is, like most people, I like what we would call tranquility. So tranquility is actually where you hear natural sounds, but you don't hear man-made sounds. And I think when people sort of wanting to go and find peace and quiet in the countryside, they're not wanting complete silence. Some people do, but most people, if they went into the countryside and they heard nothing, would think, well, where's all the animals? You know, is this place dead? So actually complete silence is not actually that relaxing, I don't think, unless you go out and seek it particularly. I think what we really like is nice natural sounding places. And that's what led me to this place in the north of England, which the Campaign for Rural England identifies as the most tranquil place in England. And when they first identified it a few years back, maybe 6-7 years ago, they were a bit reticent to say exactly where it was. But they had sort of allowed me to know the coordinates of it. So I found out where it was. So I went to visit it. And the funny thing was, is it's you sort of start approaching it. First of all, it's very difficult to get to because it's got to be away from man-made stuff. So it's not near any roads. It's not near any houses. So I had to mountain bike and walk to get to this place. It was about the only place where I could do it in the time I had available. And the reason it's so quiet on sort of most of the time is because actually it's mostly used for military training. So when the military are about, it's anything but quiet. It's actually the exit route for an RAF firing range. So when the jets are going through, there's no silence to be had there at all. But when they're not training, it was really quiet. And maybe you describe me as being miserable. Maybe I was slightly miserable there because my feet were soaked. Because it was boggy. I wasn't too sure whether I really should be there and whether I was going to get arrested by the military, because on my map it sort of said, you know, this is a bit you're not meant to go on. I think the final thing was it was actually really silent. There wasn't any natural sounds. There was a very, very occasional bird sound. So it wasn't really very tranquil. There's nowhere to sit down, so I had to stand up with soggy feet. And there wasn't even any nice wildlife to listen to.
Well, I mean miserable in the best way, because it really came through, sir. A lovely piece of writing. But actually, that's something that you come back to repeatedly in the book is the idea that we're supposed to find nature relaxing, and there have been studies and such showing that natural sounds are soothing to humans.
Yeah, it's really interesting that, I mean, even more broadly than that, there's more and more writing about how nature is good for us. And I mean, people talk about nature deficit disorder as being a problem if kids are brought up in cities and never see nature. And people are just starting to look at the role of sound has in this. And looking at birdsong is basically the only study so far on it. And I think it makes logical sense that a lot of birdsong is going to be pleasant and it's going to be nice and relaxing. So at the moment in Britain, we've got springs just come and all the songbirds are out. It's very, very beautiful. There's blackbirds and robins in my garden. Very beautiful to listen to. But there are going to be animal sounds that are not going to be relaxing and not going to be pleasant. I mean, the roar of a lion is a warning signal to us to get out of the way. So I think it seems to me that it's fairly easy to say maybe most things we look at naturally are going to be relaxing, good for us. But maybe not everything we listen to, which is from nature, is going to be good for us.
Well, something I had not even known was a thing before your book is the idea of sound conservationists.
Yeah, actually, since about the 1970s, there's been this area of study called soundscapes. And actually, it started in Vancouver with people like Murray Schafer, so across in Canada. And they started off, these people called acoustic ecologists, really just trying to find out what sounds were about and what created them and how the environment was affected by them. In the same way as you might study an animal and work out where they live, why they live, what the habitat there is, and how that influences them. So some of it is about really just understanding sounds. And that's the kind of the starting point of soundscapes. But it then is sort of grown to be larger than that. And some people have used it in sort of acoustic engineering research as a way of thinking about how we design cities to sound good. And others have gone down the lines of looking at, well, what are the sounds that we should be trying to protect or preserve or at least record for prosperity, which might be dying out.
And well, just like light pollution, there is something known as sound pollution too.
Yeah, I mean, most people will be very familiar with noise pollution. I live in a city, and the sort of background sort of soundscape I listen to is mostly the drone of motorways and cars and aircraft. So yeah, there's this smog of sound over a city, and it's mostly transportation noise. And that prevents you hearing some of the nice things of life, like birdsong. And it also affects how birds sing. So it also affects the wildlife itself.
And I'm specifically thinking the wildlife underwater.
Yes, we kind of think that, you know, noise pollution is a big problem above in airborne, you know, in where we inhabit. But actually, it's even worse for sea creatures. Most aquatic life, if not all aquatic life, uses sound in some way, because sound goes over long distances underwater. And also looking for people underwater is difficult, or looking for animals, because the light doesn't travel very far underwater. So most aquatic animals communicate using sound. And we've got a really nasty, noisy environment caused by things like shipping. So there's lots of studies at the moment looking at the effects that long-term noise has, like shipping lanes has on animals, but also short-term loud noises like military sonar or pile-driving wind farms, and how these might affect animals in the short term as well.
Well, I love your journey into sound, but it seems like you visited a lot. So are there other places on your sound bucket list?
I feel I've exhausted a lot of places I want to go to, but people keep suggesting new ones. So I guess one I'd like to go back to that I never actually heard that I have been to, which is in Australia. That's the lyrebird. And when I was in Australia, it was before I wrote the book and before I was doing sound tourism, I never really kind of thought about it. So I never went and sought out the lyrebird, which is this the most amazing mimic in the world. So we're kind of used to the idea that parrots kind of mimic speech. Well, these lyrebirds, these superb lyrebirds, particularly in the rainforest, mimic everything. So you can they'll clear a sort of platform to sing on for sort of, let's say, 20 minutes, and they'll start off singing, you know, kookaburra sounds and whitbird sounds. So they impersonate the sounds of the birds they've heard in the rainforest, and then they start impersonating human sounds as well. So they'll impersonate the sound of camera shutters of the tourists who've been taking pictures of them, or the chainsaws of the distant sort of foresty workers, or the car alarms going off. So they amalgamate everything they've heard, man-made or natural, into this most amazing and complicated song.
I was wondering if you would want to visit the sound on other planets, because you wrote a bit about that, and we do know something about it.
Yeah, there's been an interest in exploring planet acoustics. I think starting off mostly because microphones are relatively low power and can be carried on spacecraft relatively easily. And one of the advantages of microphones as a sensor is you can see things that you know which your camera can't see. You can hear what might be behind a hillock if you can't see with the cameras on your robot on the planet. So as interest in using them, microphones as sensors, and so people have started thinking about, well, what would it sound like? And you have to find a place, obviously, with an atmosphere, so you can't go into outer space. So you have to find a place like Mars or Venus or something that's got an atmosphere on it. And it distorts the voice in the same way as when you take helium in, your voice gets distorted because you change the gas inside. Your voice gets distorted by the different gas concentrations that actually would be on the planet. So, of course, some of these you wouldn't want to take your spacesuit helmet off because you die from asphyxiation or whatever the gases are. But if you could, it would distort your voice in some marvelous ways.
So then what's next for you?
What's next? I've got a big project going on about the future of spatial audio. So spatial audio, you would have met in the cinema. So you sat in the cinema and heard the sound all around you in the cinema. Well, it's never really taken off in the home. So we have systems like 5.1 home theatre systems, but they've never really taken off. And so we've got a big project involving many universities and the BBC here in the UK to look at what the future technologies might be for audio in the home. What do people really want in the home? Because we've got to remember, in a cinema, you're going to sit down and watch a film. But at home, you might be sitting, doing your Facebook page at the same time, chatting to the kids, doing all sorts of kind of things while watching television. Do you want that full immersive cinema experience? Some of the time, all the time. And so it's partly about what do the listeners want, but also what technologies can deliver that sound. Because in a cinema, you have a very controlled situation. You know exactly where the loudspeakers are. You have treated the room carefully. You can't do that at home. People need to live in their homes. So what can we do in a real living room?
Brilliant. Trevor, fascinating topics. Absolutely. And thanks very much for being here.
Thanks very much.
And we've linked to Trevor Cox and his book, Sonic Wonderland, on our site at scienceforthepeople.ca. This is Science for the People, and we'll be back to talk with Dr. Andrew Wise about a cochlear implant that delivers gene therapy. Stay tuned.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're looking at how worldwide environmental challenges interact with our increasingly global economy. We'll speak to Amy Larkin, founder of Nature Means Business, about her book, Environmental Debt: The Hidden Costs of a Changing Global Economy. Journalist Ken Silverstein joins us to explain the way climate change is dividing the insurance and energy industries. And we'll talk to Arjun Hoekstra, professor of water management at the University of Twente, about the economic effects of water scarcity. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
This is Science for the People, and before we go, I wanted a quick word with Dr. Andrew Wise. Andrew is a senior research fellow at the Bionics Institute, and his research examines strategies to deliver drugs to the inner ear in order to protect against progressive hearing loss and improve the performance of cochlear implants by protecting auditory nerves and residual sensory cells. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So we've all seen those heartwarming videos about the people who have just received their first cochlear implant, and they can suddenly hear sound and everyone's crying and it's very lovely. But those implants have limitations, right? They're great with speech, but not so great with pitch?
That's correct, yeah. So let's say that the cochlear implant performance can be quite profound and have profound influences on people's lives. So they do pretty much the job that they're designed to do, which is restore some speech understanding to people. And particularly if you can get them in to children at an early age, they can develop language skills and pronunciation skills that are not too dissimilar to normal hearing children. So they do have a profound influence on people's lives, but there are some significant limitations on their performance, and a lot of research teams around the world are trying to develop strategies to improve their performance, and in particular address some of the significant limitations of the current designs.
Well, it's just been figured out a way to use the cochlear implant itself to deliver gene therapy, which would help regrow auditory nerves. So maybe can you explain how and why all that works?
Just to slightly correct you on one point. So the implant doesn't itself deliver the gene therapy. So the gene therapy is delivered at the time of implantation of the implant. And what the implant does is it enables the gene, the DNA construct, to enter the cell, the target cell. So by using the cochlear implant to create an electric field within the cochlea, you can open up pores or increase the permeability of various cell types to this DNA material that you're aiming to introduce.
Well, you were a part of some fascinating research recently. Why don't you explain how and why all of this works?
I suppose it all harks back to, you know, the limitations of the current cochlear implants. And although recipients do very well in quiet listening conditions, when you have background noise, such as if you're at a busy restaurant or something, the implant recipients really do quite poorly in those sort of challenging listening environments, and particularly with comprehension of some languages, like for instance the tonal languages that provide a lot of information in the pitch of their pronunciations, the implant performance is quite, well, limited under those situations. And part of the problem is the way that the implant works, and the limitation comes from the, I suppose, the imprecise way that the neurons are activated by the cochlear implant. Normally, in a normal hearing individual, you can get quite high auditory fidelity by specifically activating small populations of neurons, and depending upon which population of neurons you activate, you can provide information on the pitch of the input. But with the cochlear implant, because of the broad spread of electrical currents in the cochlea, that activation of those neural populations is quite broad and very imprecise. So a lot of our strategies are designed around ways to improve the precision of the cochlear implant by ways of limiting the effective spread of activation from the device. And you can do that with a number of different strategies. One particular way is to try and focus the electric fields in the cochlea with the existing implant. And another way, which is increasingly I suppose getting a lot of focus, is by improving the nerve electrode interface by regrowing the auditory neurons close to where the electrode array is. And if you can do that, then you can potentially improve the precision of the cochlear implant.
So is it, it was already understood that auditory nerve endings could regenerate via gene therapy. So is what's new here the delivery method itself?
Yes, that's right. So the novelty of this approach is the way of, or the mechanism of introducing the genetic material into the cell types. So a lot of gene therapy that's been done previously, and a lot of our work has used viral vectors. So little bits of virus that are, I suppose, cut down to their most basic form. And you can, on these little bits of virus, you can add DNA for various sort of proteins and introduce these gene constructs into a cell. And the virus is, I suppose, the conduit to get your DNA construct into the cell. The novelty of this approach is it's not using a viral mechanism to introduce the gene. It's actually using the electric field that's generated by activation of the cochlear implant itself. So by electrically generating an electric field within the cochlea, you can increase the permeability of the cell to introducing this genetic material. So it's a new way of introducing a bit of genetic material into a cell type.
So were the usual methods not working, or does this method just work better?
I don't think it's shown yet that this method works better. It's a different way of introducing the gene. Although there are some gene therapy approaches that are in clinical trial at the moment, one of the big concerns with gene therapy is the use of the viral vector and what safety concerns that this may have for long-term gene expression. So I suppose one of the advantages of this approach is that you don't need to use this virus as a conduit to get into the cell. You can use just the electric field that's generated by the electrode implant.
Now, you've only tried this on animal models so far, right?
That's correct, yes.
Do you foresee any challenges trying it on humans?
There are a number of clinical trials that are using gene therapy in human conditions. And in fact, I understand there's a clinical trial that's going to be introducing a gene called ATOH1, which is a hair cell transcription factor, and that's going to be trialed in human recipients. So it's still on that translational stage. So a lot of the preclinical work that we do is trying to answer a number of crucial questions. One is the efficacy of this approach. Does it work? The second question, is it safe? What are the implications for human recipients that would potentially get this therapy? Is it going to be safe for the long term? And will it work in the long term? A key requirement is that of a gene therapy is it's a one-hit shot. So you apply the therapy once in the person's life, and it should give long-lasting clinical benefits. So all those three questions really need to be addressed before it's going to be a viable clinical therapy for people.
And we should mention, just like with cochlear implants, this only works on certain kinds of hearing problems, right?
Yes. So cochlear implants typically and historically have been restricted to people with quite profound hearing loss. So they have very, very minimal acoustic hearing, although there's an increasing trend to implant people who have some residual hearing from particularly in the low pitch auditory range. So there is a trend to move towards people with some functional hearing, and in particular gene therapy might be more applicable to people with some residual hearing, where if you can augment that residual hearing or maybe even protect that residual hearing from damage from the implantation of the electrode array, I think that would be a very viable target population for this type of approach.
And of course, if all of this goes well with the human trials, then you could use this method to treat other neurological disorders?
Yes, particularly disorders that are treated with bionic devices. The limitation of the cochlear implant is pretty much across the board. Any bionic device suffers from imprecise electrical stimulation, failure to activate the target neurons, and or activating unwanted neuronal populations that lead to side effects. So we have a bionic eye project where we have implanted a number of blind people with early stage developmental device, and providing that can provide visual percepts to these patients. But one of the big limitations is the precision of our electrical stimulation is quite low. So the people who are perceiving these visual percepts don't really see a picture or a face. They might see flashes of light, and that may enable them to navigate around their environment, but they won't be able to read a newspaper, for instance. And to improve those devices, it's most likely going to need a combination of advances in engineering, so the actual devices themselves, but also embracing the biology of the system and improving the interface between the target neuron population and the device itself. And therapies such as this gene therapy, one of the things in the toolkit that may provide benefits in the future.
Now, how long have you been working on this?
So we've been working in gene therapy for probably about 8 years now. Our approach has mainly been focused on viral gene therapy, so using little bits of virus and attaching our genes of interest, and we've mainly focused on delivering neurotrophin gene therapy. So neurotrophins are proteins that are normally expressed within most parts of the body, but in particular the inner ear, and when someone has or when someone is deaf, they lose their sensory cells that are a major source of these neurotrophins. So the loss of this neurotrophin supply means that the neurons no longer have these important proteins, and they can start to die and degenerate. And as the cochlear implant targets the auditory neurons, the death of these cells and the degeneration of these cells can have quite significant impacts for the performance of the device. So we've been looking at ways to restore this neurotrophin supply in a safe, effective manner that is effective over the long term, and gene therapy definitely does tick a number of those boxes.
So is this considered the home stretch then, since you've been working on this for 8 years?
I think there's still a lot of water to flow under the bridge at the moment. Some of the issues are the longevity of the gene therapy. We've shown gene expression in the cochlear for up to 6 months, but one of the problems that we're facing is the ongoing pathology that's driving the hearing loss can also limit the expression of the gene therapy. So if your cells that have been transfected and are producing and releasing your target protein, for instance, neurotrophins, if they're dying over time due to the ongoing pathology, then the effectiveness of your therapy is going to diminish. So that's one of the big questions that we're dealing with at the moment. There's other approaches to actually regenerate or renew the lost sensory hair cells, and those sort of approaches are probably even further in the future, because the structure of the cochlear is such that there's quite an intricate network of supporting cells that are also damaged in a pathological case. So it's not only do you have to restore the functional sensory hair cells, but you have to restore the cellular architecture that supports these cells and enables them to function in a normal manner. So it's quite a complex system that needs to be restored. So I imagine that gene therapy for the restoration of hearing is probably even further down the line.
So maybe not the home stretch, but as you said, it's one more tool in your toolbox potentially.
That's right. But I think we are getting closer to augmenting the performance of a device like the cochlear implant by embracing a biological intervention in addition to advances in the hardware and software. So I think we're up to the stage where we see that advances or improvements in cochlear implant performance aren't necessarily going to come from improvements in the engineering or the design of the devices themselves, or even in the way that the sound information is processed and provided to the recipient. It's going to be ways that combine improving the interaction between the electrical stimulation and the biological response. So I think that's where the developments and the improvements are going to come in the future.
Andrew, great to have you here.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
And we've linked to Dr. Andrew Wise on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Shell.